This is a test.
Testing. Sammy's mic.
What are you testing?
Sammy's blue mic.
Yeah. Yeah.
And this is my beta voice.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
this
come on.
This is my high voice.
And how's this sound?
This is like, that's actually not normal. I don't think you test like that. I think you have to like test normal, like actually speaking the way we're going to speak.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so this is my normal voice, and I'm looking at my Q4 allocations of assets.
Okay, sounds good.
Welcome to the Invest Like a Boss podcast.
I'm Sam Marks.
And I'm Johnny FD. We're self-made entrepreneurs who invest our own money and use modern technology to invest like a boss.
Join us each week for exclusive interviews with our network of modern investors, business owners, and multimillionaires to discover new ways to invest our hard-earned cash.
Hey guys, this is Johnny, and welcome to episode 112 of the Invest Like a Boss podcast. I'm sitting here in Chiang Mai, Thailand, with Sam Marks. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Johnny. Looking forward to this episode. It's been a long time coming, buddy.
Yeah, this has been one of the most highly anticipated episodes. People have been asking for this, and I think this is also one of those episodes where you will want to share with your friends and your family, maybe some of your coworkers that you really like, and it's been one of those things. So if you guys don't know what FIRE is, it is financial independence with the option of retiring early.
F-I-R-E, FIRE.
Yeah, so big shout out to Mr. Money Mustache, who popularized the term, as well as the guys in the Choose FI community, as well as all the kind of FIRE people out there. There's a ton of people who are into financial independence, retire with the option to retire early. And Sam and I are very fortunate. Well, I don't know if the word is fortunate, but we figured out some a way where we both have retired early, and we figured out a lot of things on the way. So in this episode, we're going to be talking about not only our personal journeys, but how you guys can do it as well.
Absolutely. I'm looking forward to it. And I think everyone before the FIRE, F-I-R-E movement really got popularized, it was always around, right? I mean, our parents and our grandparents always thought about retiring early, financial independence, not having a job, doing what they do, what they want to do. I think with the internet, there's just been this massive influx of information and material around ways to do it. And now it's becoming a really popular movement. And there's a lot of back studies and a lot of different strategies that you can employ yourself, try to make it happen. And as Johnny said, just a few things that we're trying to cover on this episode, because it's been a long, it's been 112 episodes. I think this was one of the first requested episodes. And we've never done a dedicated one on it. And I know it's been a lot of fun to kind of put some material together and even think about it ourselves. So some things we're going to cover on this are, well, let's see, benefits of retiring early, reasons to do it, of course, some calculations in there, strategies that we've employed, and you know, what do you do once you become a FIRE, well, part of the FIRE movement, right?
Yeah, so we'll talk about the 4% rule, the pros and cons of it, how to calculate it, what it actually is. We'll talk about how to, you know, cut expenses using things like location arbitrage, tax savings, you know, kind of living cheaper as a minimalist, how to earn more money, have a windfall, how to actually achieve FIRE. And then once you achieve it, what life actually is like, because both Sam and I were able to hit our FI numbers, our financial independence numbers. Sam in his, what, late 20s, when you're 28, was it?
28.
And me in my, when I was 35. Mm-hmm. And we both had very different paths. Mine was probably more traditional compared to what a lot of people back home, and maybe including yourself, would be like.
Well, do give us the kind of the 60-second qualification of you as a what do you say, a FIRE individual, a FIRE?
Someone who's hit FI.
Okay.
Right?
Okay.
So hit FIRE. I had a normal life, grew up in California, you know, low-income parents that we said we were middle-income, but we really weren't. And actually, it's funny. I didn't remember this because I was too young, but my sister just posted on Facebook that when we grew up, until I was maybe, I don't know, 6 or 7, we grew up in a one-bedroom apartment with the four of us in San Francisco. So they never made that much money. I grew up very frugal. But I went to college, put myself through university with a little bit of help from my parents, got a good corporate job, made normal corporate money, $48,000 a year, big U.S. corporation. But then I took a early, I wouldn't even call it retirement because I wasn't earning any money, mm-hmm. but I took a midlife crisis break, moved to Thailand to live cheaply for the next 8 years. I was living on a $600 a month budget. Wow. While working side jobs, mostly in scuba diving, a little bit of Muay Thai. And then I realized in my 30s that I had to actually earn money because I can't do this forever. Mm-hmm. So that's when I turned it all around, started online businesses, started saving 75% of my total, you know, take home income. And I was able to basically hit my FI number. We'll get into that within 5 years, which I think to a lot of people is kind of a dream, but it's not as hard to do once we explain the numbers behind it, how to do it.
I think this, the coolest part about your story is that you've employed so many of these different strategies together to achieve it. Whereas counter to my story, which was basically just, you know, the hyper entrepreneur route, yours is a route that I think is more practical. And you also, you went through the turmoil and the lifestyle compromise of living off, say, $600 a month, which is inspiring because that's not something that a lot of people think they can do, right? And because you lived through that, now that's a crucial part of your story. And it's something that makes everything that you've achieved so much better because you went through that and you compromised and sacrificed and found a way through, you know, what would be a really, really hard struggle for a lot of people.
Yeah, definitely. I think I appreciate life more, but also I have the comfort of knowing that because I was able to live off of $600 a month for so many years, that if, you know, S hit the fan, yeah, I can go back to that and I'll be fine. And I think that's a very comforting feeling, knowing that if I really needed to, I could reduce my total expenditure back down to $7,200 a year and be able to get by. Sam's number is very, very different. I think it's something that's very aspirational to a lot of people. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of people in, maybe not in the FIRE movement itself, but just in general, want to retire with, you know, not just enough to get by and be able to live the cheapest life, but be able to have multi-millions in the bank, so still be able to have six figures in income, to be able to enjoy life, do the nice things, go on nice trips, fly business class, you know, have a nice car, and not just, you know, get by living van life until you're, you know, into retirement, or living in a cheap place like Thailand, but being able to travel and go to kind of more expensive places.
Right. Yeah. So I think that was all my early aspirations, was to try to do it and achieve a high net wealth early on, so that I could do all the things that I really want to do and keep adventuring while I'm young before I got married and had kids and have a very exciting chapter of my life. And I guess for any of the new listeners that are not familiar with the podcast or Johnny and my background, you just got Johnny's as achieving FIRE. And mine, I guess, just kind of a quick 30 seconds was in college, went to Florida State University, had some tough times there, got arrested 5 times my freshman semester, if you can imagine that. Kicked out of my major as criminology, was forced basically, it was like double secret probation at Florida State, and was pretty much getting kicked out of school, but managed a way to stay in and had to switch my major to the only major that would accept me, which was business, trying to force myself into figuring out how to have my own business because, let's face it, no one was going to hire me after college with no experience and 5 misdemeanors. So I started the entrepreneur route at a very young age, basically 18, 19 years old, created a website in college that I built up and sold. And the financial impact of that was pretty limited, but the network and resources that I gained through that experience were have been lifelong. And when I was 24, I started a company called SkySig in the UK. And when I was 28, we sold that, became Europe's largest e-cigarette company. And we sold it, and all the partners did very, very well. And I guess as part of the struggle, aside from the legal and judicial turmoil that I went through in college, and when we were building SkySig, I was living off $1,500 a month in the UK. So $1,500 a month in a third world country is one thing. $1,500 a month in the UK, if anyone's lived in the UK or really anywhere in the West, you can imagine. I mean, it's microwave food. It's bread for breakfast only. And it's living in a shared crappy flat and walking everywhere and having just enough money for a couple beers. So I've done the whole super frugality thing. I'm like, Johnny, it's funny looking back now at our current expenses and thinking back to when we were living off $1,000 a month, thinking how we did it, but we did do it and life wasn't terrible. So it's comforting knowing that you can go back there if you need to, and you can always cut expenses and have quality life.
Yeah, definitely. And if you guys want to hear more about the backstories, listen to episode 1 and episode 2. Mm-hmm. Sam's was episode 1. Mine was episode 2. You can hear about how what the 5 misdemeanors misdemeanors were, but it was basically underage drinking, so don't worry about him being some kind of super criminal.
And you guys, stay tuned to the end of this episode because we're going to talk a little bit about our current financial status, our current spends, and the way that we invest to maintain our lifestyle.
Definitely. So let's actually just jump straight into it. So what are some of the benefits of financial independence or being able to retire early?
Why don't you give me one and I'll give you one as it comes to.
Yeah. So for me, it really is being able to not have to be somewhere, not have to commute to work, not have to be in an office and just hate my life, you know, not have to look forward to the next vacation. You know, just having the freedom, I would say the freedom of time and freedom of money. It doesn't mean that I have unlimited money and I can fly first class or I can do whatever I want. It's that I have enough freedom where I have at least the same amount of freedom as I did kind of vacation-wise. You know, it's not that I need to all of a sudden have a super yacht, but being able to go fishing at the lake or being able to go for a picnic or, you know, when I have kids, being able to spend more time with my kids, being able to do that, to me, was the primary reason why I wanted to hit this FI number and not have to work unless I wanted to.
Love it. For me, I think the earliest inspiration, aspiration I had for this was my aunt and uncle. Typical to so many people in the U.S., they work a long career, save money, and then, you know, they look forward to retirement when they're 65. When my aunt was 64, she got Alzheimer's, had to quit her job, and then my uncle had a heart attack and died instantly. So they worked their entire life and were never able to enjoy the retirement that they had eventually saved up and would have been able to enjoy because life happens, right? So at a young age, I was hit with that experience, and I just wanted to do it early. I figured when I'm, you know, 20, you can really gamble with a lot of things in your life. And if you happen to be successful and make it and achieve it, then you can really enjoy it, and you have a lot longer to enjoy it than if you do it later in life.
Yeah, I definitely agree. A big lesson to me came from meeting a guy at a Pete's Coffee in San Francisco. We were sitting next to each other at a table, and we're chatting about our lives, and he had just retired, and he was 67, and he was talking about wanting to travel, you know, and what to do with his life now. But you can tell he didn't have the energy anymore. He didn't have the health and the you know, being able to be so vibrant to be able to do all the things he wanted to do. So finally, he had the freedom of time because he's retired, he doesn't have to work. He has the freedom of money because he, you know, is able to live off of the retirement savings now. But he no longer has the freedom of health and movement and, you know, and kind of that. It's just there's something to be said about youth. When we're young, we just have so much more energy to enjoy life so much more.
Sure.
And it's not that it's impossible to hike, you know, Mount Everest when you're 65, but you probably won't enjoy it as much, or even just day-to-day backpacking or traveling. There's a lot of things you won't enjoy as much when you're, you know, 65 plus.
Yeah.
One of the big questions that people ask is, how do you know what the number is? What is your magic number to be able to retire? And I think if you ask most people who have never really looked into the movement, or people who, just like a layman, just if you ask coworkers, your family, your friends, they'll either name some crazy number, like, oh, I'll probably need, you know, $50 million. Mm-hmm. Or they'll just make up a number, which they actually don't really know what it means. You know, some people might say, oh, I need $50,000 to retire, and it might be way too low. Some people might just say $1 million just because it sounds like a nice round number. Mm-hmm. But I think calculating that number is actually the first step, and a lot of people don't realize how to do it.
So how do you do it?
So it's actually pretty simple. Mm-hmm. You basically just figure out what your annual expenditures are. So you add up how much you spend per year for rent, insurance, food, you know, kind of all the things that you need to spend money on when you're, if you were retired, and or just even now, right? And you just multiply that by 25.
So if your spends were $100,000, just to give an easy example, $2.5 million is what you need.
Yeah, that is the number. Now, the nice thing is we can kind of manipulate that number. The easiest way is to lower our annual spend. So if you can get your annual, you can cut your annual spend in half. So, you know, no one really needs to live off $100,000 a year. Maybe you can live off of $50,000 a year. And all of a sudden, your magic number, your retirement number, can now be 1.25 million. And that is much easier to get to than 2.5 million. It's, you know, and it's one of those, and we'll talk about a bunch of ways to actually even get to that number, because some people might be listening thinking, I can't get to that number, it's impossible. Mm-hmm. But I would guarantee that if you follow the advice from this episode and you look at, you start investing a bigger portion of your money every single month and you use a compound interest calculator, you'll realize that every single person in the world can retire with at least $1 million.
Yeah. It's interesting. This whole movement is all about retiring early. And these numbers are a lot easier to calculate when you're 60 and you kind of have an understanding of what your life might be like the next 20 years. But if you retire when you're 30, there's just so many unknowns, right? Like, you and I don't have kids. We don't know how much that's necessarily going to cost. There's just all these unforeseeable events in the future that will really have a dramatic change on our spending. And that might just be life desires. I mean, we might hit 40 and have another midlife crisis.
Yeah.
And might want a yacht. And so I think when just caveating all these calculations, we're going to talk about the 4% rule in a minute, is just know, like, the earlier that you achieve your financial independence and have the option to retire early, the more difficult it's going to be to put an actual fixed number on it. And don't cut yourself out early, you know? So just think about that as we're running through some of the numbers and the different scenarios and the ways to achieve this stuff. I'm 33. How old are you, Johnny?
37.
37. We have a long life ahead of us. Our lives could be 120 years old. I mean, with technology and science. So we have to plan for these things. So yeah. Caveat these calculations coming up.
And that's actually something that we're going to talk about towards the end on why Sam and I both have started, I don't want to say started to work again, because none of us actually working. It's 3 p.m. on a Friday. We're sitting in Thailand sipping on turmeric lemonade.
Yeah.
And shout out to Lana Herbs again for making some really good juice. And we're enjoying life. I mean, we're not working a normal job, but both of us have taken on new projects again to increase our FI number because we want to be able to do things later in life.
Sure.
But how did we get to that first FI number? So my first FI number was, and this is completely wrong, right? And this kind of just shows the ignorance that most of us have when it comes to, you know, early retirement. My first FI number was $30,000. I thought that if I became a Thai bot millionaire, if I had $30,000, I'd be done. I really thought that.
That's crazy.
I never did the math. It seemed like such a difficult number to get to in the first place that I just threw it out there. And I was like, I don't even want to think about it, because if the number is actually too high, maybe I'll never get there.
Mm-hmm.
So I told myself, if I can have $30,000, I know I'll be okay. And to be honest, it wasn't that I thought I would be able to live forever off of $30,000. I just knew that I'd be able to take a break. I didn't know if that was going to last 2 years or 5 years or 10 years, but I just knew living cheaply in Thailand, if I hit 30 grand, I'll have that buffer. And to me, that was kind of like retirement.
You know what's crazy? That just goes to prove that everything is relative. And when you were living off $600 a month, you could see that you could retire and your quality of life was actually okay. It seems like you're living in the sticks back then. You were, but you're probably still a happy guy, right? Mm-hmm. And there's people that are living in Chiang Mai right now, not even saying foreigners, but locals, that if they had $30,000 saved, they would probably consider that retirement or having enough to retire. So it just goes to show that everyone's number is relative and it doesn't necessarily have to be a high number.
Yeah, definitely. And it's exciting when you hit it. I actually wrote about it in my book, Life Changes Quick, how in my mind, hitting $30,000, becoming a Thai millionaire was going to be kind of the ultimate goal in my life. Mm-hmm. And luckily, I didn't stop there. I think we normally don't. I think once we hit goals, there's always another goal. But I think it's okay to set more achievable goals in the beginning, as long as you continue and you just add to it.
Yeah.
So how did I do that? But also, how can you do it? How are some ways where you can hit your FI number a bit earlier, right? Mm-hmm. And I think it's good to calculate it. It'd be good if everyone kind of just paused this podcast real quick and thought about how much money you spend per month. Mm-hmm. And just multiply that by 12. So that's how much you spend per year. And then multiply that by 25, which is kind of a rough estimate based on the 4% rule, which we'll go a bit more deep into later. Mm-hmm. But that number might be, $1 million, right? And it could also be $2.5 million, depending on how much money you spend. And by far, the easiest way to hit that FI number faster is to cut your expenses.
Sure.
So a couple ways to do it. Most people that are in the FI community are in the US or Canada or living, you know, back home in an expensive place, whether it's the UK or Australia. It's hard. It is really, really hard to lower your expenses by that much because you always have to pay property tax. You always have to pay, you know, health insurance, and, you know, you always have to pay income tax, and it adds up. I remember looking at someone, you know, somebody in one of the Facebook groups. He posted his monthly expenses, mm-hmm. and he was living as cheap as possible. And he was living in a small town. I think it was somewhere in like Texas, but not Austin or even Houston. It was like some small town. And he was living in a trailer, in a you know, 2-bedroom trailer. Mm-hmm. So there was nothing else he could have done. He was, you know, driving an old truck, and his monthly expenses were still, you know, $1,700 or $2,000 a month. And it's very, very hard to get that even lower. So yes, there's a lot of things you can do, you know, move into a smaller place. You know, a lot of people look into like tiny homes or van life, or just getting a smaller apartment. A lot of people cut their food expenses. They stop eating out. They cut their Netflix, you know, package. They just find ways to save money. And I think it's a very, very good start, but it can only do so much.
Yeah, expenses are crazy. So when you get over to Thailand and living in different countries, you start realizing how many unnecessary high expenses there are where we came from. And I just realized this again because I moved back to Tampa and I got a place, I furnished it, I got a car, I got the insurance, and now I have $4,500 a month in fixed costs in Tampa that I didn't have for the last 8 years. And they can really add up quick. And I know people, in talking about the magic number, I know people that are spending $100,000 a month and they're like, dude, I need to make $1 million a year. And that's the world that they've come from. And you look at their expenses and they're just crazy, right? And there are people listening to this podcast that are spending $50,000 a month. But you have to realize that so many of those expenses are not needed, not necessary for your happiness. And you could get rid of 50% of them pretty quick if you really wanted to. So definitely take a look at managing your expenses and cutting them. And I think going into that, which would be kind of the number two way that we've been able to employ generating financial freedom and having the ability to retire early with limited expenses, is location arbitrage.
Yeah, and I think it's really cool that we have both you and I on this podcast, because we kind of come from two different worlds, where some people might be listening to this thinking, who in the world is spending 50 grand a month? Mm. Or who in the world is spending 100 grand a month? And coming from, you know, the way I grew up, you know, to me, spending more than 5 grand a month is insane, mm. right? But there are a lot of people who are in that situation. You know, a lot of entrepreneurs or doctors or lawyers.
Yep.
They just, you know, they send their kids to private school. They have 2 car payments. They have a big mortgage. They have a, you know, vacation.
They have alimony.
Yeah.
I mean, I knew somebody that's paying $30,000 a month in alimony.
Yeah. It's insane. It's
crazy.
I think it's fair to say that almost whatever we are spending back home, it's possible to cut in half. So if you're spending 5 grand a month, it's possible to spend $2,500 a month.
Sure.
Yeah. And moving out here to Thailand, I've been able to cut that expense. I was spending $3,000 a month living in California, mm-hmm. and this was a basic life. Studio apartment, you know, used car, eating out twice a week. Here in Thailand, I am spending about $1,200 a month.
What?
Yeah, $1,200 a month.
Oh my God.
I eat out probably 20 times a week. I get a few massages a week. I have a gym membership. I basically do what I want to do, and I really, really enjoy life here.
Yeah, so you guys can just see how the quality of life over here, the amount of money you spend doesn't reflect the quality of life you here. So I'm spending about $7,500 a month here, which is crazy. Most people in Chiang Mai will think that's insane, right?
They do.
And all the money that I'm spending, for the most part, is actually unnecessary. I'm going and buying $100 bottles of wine at Rimping. I fly business class all the time. I stay at hotels when I don't need to stay at hotels just because I want to try new things. And then I have a girlfriend so my expenses in some ways are kind of 2x. But when I first got here, I was spending only a couple thousand a month, and you can easily do that. So expenses are relative, not necessarily correlated with your quality of life. And just on the location arbitrage thing, give me an example or two of people that you know that are doing location arbitrage, meaning making money in a high price, high income place, but living in a low cost, inexpensive place.
Yeah, I mean, basically everyone that I interview on the other podcast, Travel Like a Boss, is working, you know, online, either making money from the US or Europe, somewhere, Australia. And, you know, whether they're making, you know, 30 grand a year from it, you know, when they're just starting out, or if they're making 100 grand a year, they're, I would say on most people, they spend between, I want to say, $1,000 to $1,500 a month, regardless of how much the money they make. Because aside from buying $100 bottles of wine, there's actually not that much to spend money on in Chiang Mai or in Thailand in general.
You can't really blow money here.
It's really hard. I mean, you know, I live in a very, very nice condo with a pool. You know, it's everything's furnished, everything's new, and it's $450 a month. If I wanted to get the nicest place I can find in Chiang Mai, it's maybe $1,000 a month. Mm-hmm. It is really, really hard, you know, unless I'm just checking into a hotel for 30 days, you know, and paying, you know, normal hotel prices. It's really hard to spend more.
I'll give you another example of someone that's doing location arbitrage that's been hanging out a lot in Chiang Mai recently is Bob Sapp. So I've been hanging out with him a little bit here and there, doing Muay Thai. And he just moved from Guatemala. So he's a classic example. He's been making money in Japan and Korea and the U.S. for a long time doing, you know, entertainment essentially, which is in the form of fighting. But he doesn't always want to put himself in harm's way these days. But he still makes money from a lot of those countries. He's been living in Guatemala, living a really cool life, really exotic life. He just moved to Chiang Mai, and he's looking at possibly doing someplace in the Med as well. But he still gets those paychecks and royalties. But he lives a very, very simple life here. He says he buys all secondhand clothes. You know, he produces a lot of his own food. So there's somebody that's, you know, a big name, and he's doing it himself.
Yeah, there's so many ways to do it. But, I mean, in general, anybody can move to Chiang Mai and live off of about $1,000 a month.
Yeah.
You know, live in a condo. You can eat Thai food. You can get massages. And it's instantly, your quality of life will be the same or better than it was back home. And as long as you can continue to earn money in US dollars or in euros while living in a cheaper place like Thailand or, you know, really any other of these hubs, you are taking advantage of not only the cost arbitrage, where we're earning a higher wage, spending less, but we get all these other benefits like tax benefits.
Tax benefits. The U.S. tax system was not written by laborers. It was written by capitalists. And once you understand how the tax system works and to how to invest and make money to your advantage, you can really excel and outpace your peers. First one, I think, would be foreigner income tax exclusion, right, Johnny?
Yeah. We had a talk about it at the Nomad Summit in Vegas earlier this year. And it's basically a way where the U.S. gives you a $103,000 tax break a year if you are out of the country for 11 months a year or more. So basically, as long as you spend 35 days or less in the U.S. per year, you don't have to pay any federal income tax on the first $103,000 a year that you earn, which is huge. That's $20,000 savings easily.
Yeah, absolutely. And then when you start talking about your income sources and how you structure that, it can get super complicated, but let's use yours, for instance. What was your, do you know your effective tax rate last year?
It was really low. I mean, I made $183,000 last year and I paid like $5,000 in taxes, you know, and I just followed, I took advantage of all these different hacks, right? And, you know, these are legal loopholes. I mean, I go through a tax expert who just specializes in foreign earned income tax. So a couple things is, one is I left California a few years ago. Mm-hmm. I mean, I haven't actually lived in California in like 10 years now. So 5 years ago, I officially moved to Texas because I wasn't spending any time in the US anyways. Now I have to pay zero state income tax, just legally, because I'm not a California resident. There's no state income tax in Texas. And I have this $103,000 tax break. And then there's, you know, more advanced things you can do as well. You can have your money go through you know, an international business first. Mm-hmm. So, for example, you can, you know, the company can be set up in Belize, and then that company pays you $103,000 a year or less, and then it's, they're just all these other benefits.
Sure.
But these things would not be possible if I was living in the US. Right. So location arbitrage opens up so many doors.
Right. So Barcelona, wonderful place to move, very similar to California. But if you live in Barcelona, you immediately are getting away. It's like living in a state-free tax in the US. It's like living in Florida or Texas if you live in Spain. You're not going to have to pay any state tax. You're not going to pay city tax, any of that local tax. Your sales tax is very minimal, and you're in a much less expensive place to begin with. And then you start talking about types of income. The most inefficient income is earned income, ordinary income. If you start investing in a lot of things that we're invested in, like dividend paying stocks, municipal bonds, you know, you can basically make money tax free or at a much, much lower income rate, say tax rate of 15% on dividend stocks, capital gains 15%, 20%, versus if you're a high earner in the US, you're paying 38% on some of that money, 35 on a lot, 30 on others. So you start thinking about how much that impacts your net, your take home at the end of the year. It's massive. And if you do that and compound that over the course of, say, 10, 15 years, it's life-changing money.
It's giant. So definitely the easiest way to take advantage of location arbitrage is to find a job that lets you work from home or work remotely and just live somewhere cheaper, like in, you know, Mexico, if you want to stay in the US time zone, or in Thailand, if you want to be out here. But if you really want to level that up, highly recommend starting your own business. Become an entrepreneur, be a small business owner, you know, whether it's book publishing or starting an e-commerce store or having a product on Amazon. There's so many ways now of creating a business online. And what that allows us to do is it allows us to just not be responsible for kind of wage tax on a W-4 form. Mm-hmm. I think every single person who really wants to take advantage of tax breaks needs to be paid on a 1099, you know, which is an independent contractor. Mm-hmm. That way you can expense everything. I mean, you can expense your travel to Thailand. You can expense your hotels here. You can expense, you know, your monthly accommodation here. You can expense so many meals and your laptops and like pretty much everything if you are if you're a sole proprietor even.
What percentage of your expenses would you say you try to make a business expense?
I try to make 100% of it a business expense. Some things just aren't realistic, you know? Like if I'm, you know, buying groceries, mm-hmm. and especially back, you know, when I am in California, you can't really justify that, right? It's hard. Right? It's
hard. I don't know. Yeah. There's always, it depends on the more things you're involved with, and especially something like the podcast, right? If the podcast is generating money or flowing back to some of the other things that you have going on, I mean, you can almost, most things are a legitimate business expense if you actually start thinking about it, right? Even like the groceries, for instance, like you're not going to be able to do 100%, but you can certainly say, hey, I got meals and drinks for a podcast event that I was hosting, right? And you start looking at your life expenses when you get involved in some of these things, and you start saying, wow, almost every single thing can literally be a business expense, which you're not necessarily going to get to write off this year as an operating expense. But in my case, I'm invested in startups almost all around the world, businesses all around the world. If I fly to that destination, that might not get written off this year's taxes, but it will add to my cap table. So eventually, if there's a gain or I write it off as a loss, that's all coming off and it's going to be a tax deduction.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, mine's a lot simpler. I just charge everything as a business expense. Mm-hmm. If I'm going to fly somewhere, I guarantee I have a meeting set up. I have a podcast interview set up.
Right.
I have something, you know, I'm writing a blog post or YouTube video about it. There is something I am doing to make that a business trip primarily. And, you know, if I happened to be attending, you know, someone's wedding there, that is a secondary, sure. you know, reason to be there.
Yeah. So I think the 1099 thing is super important. And I think that so many people out there have the ability to do that and they don't even know it. It might just be a job that they have and they say, you know what, I just want to restructure this. I want to be a contracted worker. And people really, we're going to talk about this in a second with the fourth one coming up, which is just earn more money. But people that are good workers, not everyone out there is an entrepreneur. Not everyone's going to start their own business and have a big successful exit. You might be just a kick-ass employee and you might be comfortable having a job. And if you're good at what you do, you have a lot of leverage and you have the ability to go out and restructure the way that you're set up as an employee. You have the ability to go out and work on your location independence and you have the ability to make more money.
I have a friend who was a programmer And, you know, and he worked for Comcast. It was like the crappy.
Comcastic.
No, it's a terrible company. But what he did was he, and, you know, he said, hey, I want to move to New York. And they said, why? We don't have an office there. And he said, I want to live in New York. And they, and he basically just said to them, like, you either let me move to New York and work remotely, or you can fire me and, you know, you can hire someone else. Mm-hmm. And because he was a good worker, they kept him on board and they just let him live in New York and work from there. So it was kind of a, I mean, financially it was a stupid move on his part because he was getting paid the same, but now living in a more expensive city. But he could have also just did the exact same thing and said, you know, I'm going to move to New York, but actually move to Thailand or move to, you know, Barcelona or something.
I hear these happening all the time. And people get so worked up about going in and asking for a raise or trying to become a contractor instead of an employee. They get so worked up and they don't realize, like, they have so much room to go. If you're performing for that company, you have so much room. I'll give you a quick example. My buddy was a sales guy for Bumblebee Tuna in San Diego. He's a big surfer guy, wanted to try something new. So he went into the office and said, you know, I want to move to Bali for a while. Well, not only did they say, okay, you can move to Bali and just work for us from there. You can be a contractor instead of being an employee. You don't, you know, once he got there, he realized he could get foreign earned income tax exclusion. He got an allowance for a house. You know, he didn't make more money per se, but he got $100,000 tax free and got a free, you know, living expense for a house and stuff. And he got to live in Bali.
Yeah.
And it's because he was valuable, right?
Yeah. And I think that is a very key point that a lot of people don't think about. A lot of people just want to skate by at their job or in life, and that isn't helping anyone. That's not helping you. That's not helping your boss. That's not helping the company. That's not helping the customers that buy the products of that company. It really comes down to adding value in life and then asking for value back in return.
Boom. Asking for value back in return. And we get this question a lot in Boss Lounge, like, you know, if you have $100,000 to invest, and where would you invest it, and how much to generate another $10,000 a year in passive income? Well, to generate $10,000 a year in passive income, you probably need at least $100,000 invested in, you know, one of these mortgage servicing funds or real estate funds, at least. So that's $100,000 you need. But most people out there listening that have a job that's making $60,000, $70,000 a year, if they're good at what they do and they've been with that company for some time and are adding value, most likely they can go in and get a $10,000 raise for sure. And that's the same as having $100,000 to invest in one of these investment vehicles.
Yeah, I mean, definitely, you know, and even things like if I had a normal job, if I had to work for someone, mm-hmm. I would ask for performance-based bonuses. Whether it's becoming commission only or just having some kind of, you know, bonus, say, hey, if I make the company more money, can I have a percentage of it? And if it's a good company and they want to keep you, they want to keep you happy, there's no reason why you can't either have it at that company itself or find a job that does let you do it.
Sure. So the first three that we talked about were cutting expenses, location arbitrage, and tax savings. So all three of those are about saving. Number four was basically earn more money. And there's lots of ways you can do that, especially if you're adding value in the world. Like Johnny said, ask for value in return.
Yeah. So, you know, if you have a job, you know, get performance-based incentives, you know, ask for commissions, you know, change your pay structure, or start a side hustle, mm-hmm. you know, create a business on the side. You know, if it's not that hard to earn another $1,000 a month in a side business, whether it's an online business, you know, whether it's, you know, passive income business, but, you know, regardless of what it is, if you're willing to stay home, you know, and work on a business after work and not watch Netflix, you know, and, you know, maybe skip a couple weekends for a couple months to set something up, every single person is able to create a side hustle that to generate another $1,000 a month.
Yeah, I agree. And maybe, just maybe, you can have a big, big exit in the future and lock up your financial independence forever.
Yeah, I definitely agree. So Sam and I have both sold businesses in, you know, for different comma figures or dollar amounts. My side hustle were these dropshipping stores. You know, I took a course and learned how to do it. I did it, you know, online. I actually built all my stores while I was in Thailand. So really, there's no excuse. You know, you can do it from anywhere. And it's one of those things where I think this is where a lot of people have excuses why they can't start something on the side. You know, they're like, I don't know how to do it. Mm-hmm. I don't have the time. I guarantee every single person can make time. You know, every single person can learn how to do it. And what's nice is even having these side hustles, those earning me about $2,000 a month in profit, at the end of, you know, running the business for about 2-3 years, I decided I want to free up some time. Let me sell this business. And I was able to get 27 months of net profit ahead of time for it. Mm-hmm. So the business was, you know, would make anywhere between $1,000 to $5,000 a month. On average, it was clearing about $2,000 a month. And I got someone to buy the business for $60,000 up front. And I took 100% of that and put it into a Vanguard index fund, which is now making me on average of 10%. And that is a huge kind of, you know, like jump start.
Bump, yeah.
And I think, you know, this is the reason why I've been able to hit my FI number when I was 35 is because I've now done this multiple times. I've started and sold three of these businesses, each one. You know, the first was 60 grand, and then 57 grand, and then 44 grand. And for the last two, I had some partners of it. But what I basically did was I saved 75% of the money that I earned while running these businesses. And then I saved 100% of the money that I got from the sale.
Yeah. So if you only do the kind of the first three we talked about, which is all based around savings and tax savings and expense cutting, and you earn a little bit more, you're going to get to your number, but it's a longer road. And what can really excel that is some type of windfall, whether it's $50,000, $5 million, or $50 million. Like it's going to help accelerate everything. But it's not necessarily, the more you can generate from that, the riskier it is, right? Yeah. A lot of the stuff that I did was, you know, the difference in making a lot of money and making zero is literally like 2 days. Which way is the wind blowing, right? I mean, it's super, super risky stuff. But I think anyone going out there and at least trying to start a business, it's a good idea. I mean, don't mortgage your house to do it, but try to start something because you're going to learn a lot. You're going to make a lot of resources. And people out there, the difference in having a great idea, the difference in someone that can start a business and execute, and the difference in someone that has a good idea is just that person knowing how to the road ahead and be able to connect the dots. And when you've never done a business before, it's hard to have an idea and see where that finishes. But the person that's done a business before, even if they've failed, and especially if they've been successful, they have an idea and they say, okay, well, I can go out and get the web developers, and I know how to hire a team, and I know how to go out and raise capital, and I know how to launch this website and increase sales and, you know, optimize sales channels and things like this. And that's where most people's brains stop, because they haven't done it. And they, as soon as they have an idea, they're like, okay, I'm going to forget about that, because they don't know how to connect the dots and see the end goal. And the more that you do, and the more that you try, even if you fail, you're going to start seeing the bigger picture.
Yeah, definitely. I think one of the biggest downsides of the FIRE community is people focus almost 100% of their efforts on saving money. Mm-hmm. And I think that is very, very beneficial in the beginning because it's fast. You could literally reduce your expenses, you know, by thousands of dollars, thus increasing your savings rate by thousands of dollars almost instantly, almost overnight. You can move into a cheaper place. You can stop eating out. You can sell the car. You know, there's so many things you can do. The problem is once you've done 99% of it, trying to milk that last 1% to try to get an extra $100 a month is really, really a bad use of time. I think the ultimate formula is a combination of, you know, cutting your expenses by 50% as kind of, you know, quickly as possible, and then focusing your time on increasing your income so then you can kind of double dip that savings rate. And then if you really want that big bump, sell the business and have that big windfall, which just, you know, it's almost like a super leveling you up, like a speed boost.
Yeah, I'm always a fan and proponent of having a lottery ticket in your pocket. It makes life more exciting.
Yeah, definitely. So if you guys want to know more about starting businesses, take a listen to episode 23 of Invest Like a Boss. The episode is called From Zero to Self-Made, How to 300X Your Returns. Because at the end of the day, starting a business is the only way you can get 100% plus returns, you know, versus investing.
Instead of FIRE, you get FU money.
Yeah.
That's the only way to do it. I mean, you either have to start a business and have a big windfall, or you have to be a celebrity or super sports player, you know, super athlete. But it's the only way to get really, really big cash and do for sure everything you want to do for the rest of your life.
Yeah, I definitely agree. So I think it's, you know, right now people are thinking, okay, this sounds fun. I can do this. But they're thinking, like, what are... Like some people are thinking, well, I'm in debt right now. I have my student loans. I have a mortgage. What would we say to these people?
I think a prerequisite to all this stuff, even before you look at those 5 points, is you got to manage debt. Debt's not necessarily bad. I don't think you and I have a lot of experience in debt, fortunately. But, you know, we've had a bit here and there. But for sure, getting out of college with a lot of student debt or consumer debt that's had a much higher interest rate is going to be toxic to your long-term planning. If you have debt, like a mortgage on a house, or you're using debt to finance real estate and investments like that, I mean, there's lots of strategies that can accelerate. I mean, that could be another one of these 5 points, is like Kevin Shea in Hong Kong used leverage to, you know, become super wealthy in 10 years by going out and acquiring property, leveraging it. And there's tons of stories, rich dad, poor dad, that use that strategy.
Yeah, I definitely agree. It's definitely possible to climb your way out of it. It's much easier just not get yourself in it in the first place. I think this is why every single person before they turn 18 needs to listen to an episode like this, you know, read a book like a, you know, finance book, because when we are 18, we don't think about the repercussions of racking up student loans. I spent so much money on stupid things with my student loan money, thinking it was free money, it's normal to have debt, it's not a big deal. If I would have known how nice it would be to, you know, to graduate from college or even just start working debt free, mm-hmm. and what would be possible, I never would have taken on $30,000 in student debt.
I had fraternity brothers that would take out student loans to go to spring break, and they would drop like $3,000 on spring break. I mean, how ridiculous is that in hindsight to graduate and have that debt?
I took out student loans to get rims on my car.
That might take the cake, buddy.
So these are, I mean, unfortunately, if you are in debt, I feel bad for you. You have to climb your way out. It's worth it at the end. I would buy the Dave Ramsey's book and just focus on that for now. You know, keep listening to this podcast as inspiration for when you get out of it, but you have to get out of it first. It's a soul crusher.
I agree totally. And if there's parents out there, introduce this concept to them at a younger age. Have them save in high school. Have them save their allowance. Have them take a summer job and focus on saving. Because that money, you know, if you can save $15,000 over summer jobs, you get out of college, you don't have car debt. You don't have student debt. You don't have a lot of things. Instead, you have a base for future success that's going to accelerate you into this movement.
Yeah, definitely. So now for the nerdy part, as promised, we're going to break down the 4% rule. A lot of people have heard of it. Most people don't understand actually how it works. So what I did was I actually opened a blank spreadsheet on Google Sheets, and I just created the formula for myself. I've done the calculators before. There are a ton of online calculators. But I promise you that if you sat down and you had to write it out, create the formulas, plug in the numbers, you'll understand it so much better. I'm going to post a link to the spreadsheet in the Boss Lounge. That way you can copy the formulas. You can take a look at the math, how it works, and then you can create your own with your own fine number, and you can take a, you know, basically do the math yourself, because I promise you it's very, very beneficial. So the way it works is I put 5 columns, starting net worth, then for this I just put $1 million as, and I'm imagining that I hit FI. This is me at some point in my life where I have $1 million in net worth and I can retire. So my FI number, $1 million. Then the next column is how much it grows every year if I assume that I can grow the portfolio by a conservative 5%. I used to think it was hard to grow a portfolio by 5%, but now after doing 111 episodes, I've realized 5% is really low and really easy. Even if I just put everything in a Vanguard low index, you know, low cost index fund, it'll probably grow between 7% and 10% on average. So that number you can actually bump up, but we're going to be super conservative, saying on average, we're going to gain by about 5% a year. Mm-hmm. And then the next column is the net total of, you know, how much we'll have after that gain. And then that's when we start calculating the 4% withdrawal rate. So the withdrawal rate, you can take it out once a year. It's probably better to take out monthly. But basically, you take 4% of your total net worth to spend. So if you had $1 million, you would take out $40,000. That's what you would live off of for the next year. Mm-hmm. And remember that the calculation of how we got $1 million is we took what we think we need to live off of and we multiplied that by 25. So in this scenario, I think I can live off of $40,000 a year. So I multiply by that 25, $1 million. And here's kind of the fun part of it is every year I'm withdrawing $40,000, but the principal, the $1 million machine, is growing as well. And when you look at these numbers, and actually, maybe Sam, why don't you come over here and just take a quick look, and that way I can kind of walk the whole thing through. So if you guys want to follow along, you can take a look at the show notes or in the Boss Lounge. But basically, the way it works is starting the second year, we've taken out $40,000, so now we have $960,000, but it grew by $48,000, which is 5%. So at the end of the year, it's one of those like kind of balancing games. It almost looks weird. It almost doesn't make sense. But when you scroll down, in the first, like, let's say 9 or 10 years, it looks like at the end of the year, you have pretty much the same amount of money because you're withdrawing 4%, but you're gaining 5%. But here's a caveat. This is what no one ever talks about, is you cannot live off of $40,000 for the rest of your life because of
inflation. Well, also what this doesn't take into consideration is taxes, unless the 5% is post-tax. And that is a very dangerous blade that kind of cuts through earnings, both when you're investing or just talking about withdrawal rates and the 4%. And I think that's where a lot of FIRE entrepreneurs get the 4% rule wrong, is they think about this stuff and they don't realize my tax bracket might be 30%, or it might be zero if you're on all municipal bonds. You can get almost 5% in municipal bonds, but the way that you structure your investments and how you put that money to work is going to be uber important.
Yeah, definitely. So kind of an easy way to calculate that would be the 4%, that FI number, you have to figure out like before tax, how much money do I need? So $40,000 a year, if you think about it, would be $3,300 a month, which would be great. People think, I can live off of that. Mm-hmm. It's fantastic. But if you factor in tax, and now you're taking out
20% or something on 50.
Yeah, maybe now you have $2,500 a month, and for you that might not be enough now. So that FI number might be higher. And what the kind of the real tricky math part is adjusting for inflation. So what we So basically, the way the inflation works is first year we take out $40,000. Next year, because our buying power would be lower. And this is the easy way to think about it is, how much did a bowl of noodles or, lunch cost 3 years ago versus now? And on general, it goes up by about 2% a year. Mm-hmm. So $40,000 next year doesn't buy you what it did this year. So we have to just add 2% to that every year. So the first year we withdraw $40,000, next year $40,800, then $41,600. By year 10, we're withdrawing $46,000. By year 15, $51,000. Yeah. So it's kind of like you're giving yourself a 2% raise every year.
Yeah.
And what's really nice is this number, your nest egg of $1 million, actually stays about the same for about 20 years. But then it takes a huge dip because what ends up happening is, the 2% inflation starts really catching up and overtaking the 5% gains. So by year, let's say 30, you have $700,000 left. By year 35 or 36, you have, less than $500,000.
This spreadsheet gives me anxiety.
It does. It's scary. And I think this is why people need to see it.
And let me just... This is kind of the high level of what really scares me about 4% rule. I want to get your opinion on, like, is this something that you could do? But what a lot of people forget is, okay, we're assuming that everything's going at 5%, which historically would be statistically correct, at least, right? But what happens if we hit a 10-year recession. And if you're pulling money out, you're negative dollar cost averaging, right? You're pulling money out at the absolute wrong time, and that has a compounding negative effect. And okay, so maybe that's okay if you're, you know, 70, 80 and you're just kind of winding down. But if you're 35 and you have $1 million and the market pulls back, let's say 25%, all of a sudden if you're $1 million fully invested, your money is now $750,000, and all of a sudden, and it's not growing, it's going down, and you're pulling out $40,000 a year. That would look like an atomic bomb went off in your portfolio. And I don't think anyone can stomach that. It would be very, very hard to stomach that in your 30s if your income is kind of at a standstill and you're just like sitting in a hammock in Thailand. I think everyone would get super uncomfortable. And I think that's what people who are looking at employing the 4% rule at a young age are going to set themselves up for some hard times ahead.
Yeah, definitely. Because we don't know what's going to happen.
Right.
I think the way around it is a couple of things.
Yeah.
One would be being more diversified than just being in an index fund.
Mm-hmm.
One of the big downsides of most people in the FIRE movement is they calculate that, you know, they have all their investments in a Vanguard index fund. A lot of people have it 100% in the total US stock market,
yeah,
because that's kind of the easiest one. However, that leaves yourself very undiversified internationally, and that could have a chance of, you know, having that 10-year recession.
Mm-hmm.
This is why I think combining what we've discovered in, you know, doing these 111 interviews before and diversifying ourselves between different, you know, funds, like, you know, some things that pay a guaranteed 8% regardless if the economy is going up and down,
mm-hmm,
you know, some things that have potential of, you know, being higher that are like non-correlated assets that have nothing to do with the real estate market or nothing to do with the stock market.
Yeah.
I think that's what would help us sleep a lot better.
Sure, absolutely. I know that there's statistical evidence that this 4% rule has been tested through the 2007, through 2001, and I think actually through like the turmoil in the 80s. But you have to remember, like, the Great Depression was 10 years, whereas the Great Recession in 2007 was what, like 2 years or something? So things bounced back much quicker. But in the Great Depression, it didn't look like things were ever going to come back.
Yeah.
And we can't, like Johnny said, we don't know what the future holds. And I'll tell you one other thing that I said earlier in the podcast, that we don't know what the future holds, is that I think that lifespans are going to be much, much longer. And if you're in your 30s and you're planning to live by the 4% rule, you might live to be 120 years old. And you don't want to be running on fumes when you turn 80, because the problem is your ability to generate money and income when you're 80 is going to be, you might live to be 120, but you might not have the ability to work, right? You might be watching the golden years on TV all afternoon, just sipping wine. So you want to set yourself up for a much longer lifespan, and you want to set yourself up for catastrophic events.
Yeah, I definitely agree. It is scary to look at this, because what happens is after 25 years, that even though it's been floating around $900,000 or $1 million, mm-hmm, your total net worth, all of a sudden it just drops and drops and drops and drops every single year so quickly. And all of a sudden in 44 years, and for us, we'll still be pretty young then. You know, I'll be what? 37 plus 44. I'll be 81. Hopefully I'll live that long, but I do not want to be 80 years old and being broke.
Right.
I don't want to be 80 years old and have $19,000 left in my bank account and knowing that's it.
Mm-hmm.
There's no more money coming in. I can't work anymore. I'm screwed. That is a huge fear.
It's the number one fear in the world, is running out of money before while you're still alive. It's the number one fear in the world, more than public speaking, more than the fear of dying itself. And most of the questions that came in through the boss round were around the 4% rule, which makes me think that a lot of people, they want to get to their FIRE number, and then they just want to stop. And I believe that has some type of something to do with a very negative association of work. Like they're in a job that they hate, and they're grinding it out, and they're 3 years away from their number, and then they're done. But I guess we're here to tell you, and I mean, because I've known you for long and I know what you're working on, that the association with work can be beautiful. It can be the number one thing that you want to do when you wake up in the morning. It's not necessarily sitting on a beach or doing things that people would necessarily associate with being retired. Work can be awesome. And like, I know you and I have both been in jobs that we absolutely dreaded and hated getting up on the alarm and doing it. But when you have the free time and the flexibility to work on something that you like, you might find out that that becomes the number one thing that you want to do every day. And then all of a sudden making money through that activity is joy.
I 100% agree with this. Mm. I think that that's also the solution, where instead of working a job that we hate until we hit the FI number and then doing zero work and possibly being bored.
Yeah.
And not even possibly, guaranteed you will be bored.
Guaranteed.
And I know this because I took 6 months off after I hit my FI number, which was like, I think it was 600 grand. I was like, on that, I can live off of 1800 a month. And I knew that the reason why that would be fine is I was spending, you know, between 12 and 1500 a month. That gives me a little buffer. Mm-hmm. I'm okay, right? So I took 6 months off, and in the beginning, I enjoyed it, you know? I really enjoyed it. And I think I would have enjoyed it even more if I had gone from a corporate job to Thailand or Bali and just did nothing.
Sure.
But I was already kind of doing nothing, but it was still nice. But after 6 months, I was so bored. I hated it. I lost kind of all the will to do anything. And I needed something to do. And now that I started working again, you know, and maybe it was longer than 6 months, because I think it was like a year of kind of like thinking, oh, I should get back into it.
Seemed like a long time.
Yeah, it was a long time. But just a few months ago, I decided, okay, let's get back into it. So I started a bunch of projects again. I had the Nomad Summit conference I'm working on. Mm-hmm. I started another dropshipping store. Mm-hmm. And actually, this time it's like a partner program. I have like 7 people working with me. Mm-hmm. I'm starting 7 stores at once. And then I just really enjoy it. Every day I'm excited. I have energy. I don't have to go into work when I don't want to. I mean, literally, you know, we start work at 10:30 in the morning every day. Mm-hmm. Because I just like sleeping in now, and I work out of a coffee shop, you know, a 5-minute commute away, which I can just walk to, and I'm done by 2 p.m. And it's everything that my job wasn't at a corporate job.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that it's balance for most people is so important. And we all know people that are fully out of balance and they can live that lifestyle and they seem to get along with it. Personality types play a huge role in this and kind of finding your identity and what you want to work on once you hit your number. But I know for you, balance is very important. For me, balance is extremely important. I spent the last two days before today out at a Muay Thai camp. There's a pretty interesting group of people out there. It was just basically driving around outside of Chiang Mai, going to cool coffee shops, doing Muay Thai. And then last night I went to sleep. I'm like, I really want, like, I'm looking forward to getting into a co-working space, putting on some nice clothes, and doing a really productive day. And that's what I did. I was there for 6 hours and came over here to record this. And it's been a wonderful day. And I'm working on things that I look forward to opening my email. I look forward to the creativity. I look forward to talking to innovative people that have hustle. It's invigorating. Yeah. And and I think once people get out of whatever the negative association is with their work, and they have a little bit of this early retirement, I think once they find something that they really enjoy, it could just be it doesn't even have to make money. It can just be a blog. It can be something that gives you a little bit of identity. It could lose money. It could be like your Sunday golf outing, right? But once you find that, I think you're really going to love the association with work again.
Yeah, definitely. I could not agree more. So I think this is a big solution to that kind of 4% math problem. Mm-hmm. Is instead of assuming that you're never going to earn money again, assume that you may not make as much as you did before, but you'll still be able to bring in money doing something that you love doing and kind of working when you choose to work.
Yeah,
I think another couple possible solutions. One is looking at the math. It looks like if I stop increasing my withdrawal rate after at 25 years, when it gets to about 60 grand, I mean, just cap it and just tell myself, I'm going to increase by 2% every year until I hit, you know, until it starts basically losing money. And then I'm just going to cap my withdrawal at 60 grand. Mm-hmm. And I'm just going to force myself, like, I'm like, all right, well, I'll be 60 years old. I'm just going to spend less money. I'm going to have 60 grand a year. That's it. I either you know, have a side job and I make some money, or I just have to live cheaper. I think it's easy to say now. I don't know what it's going to be like when I'm actually 60 and all of a sudden my money is, you know, is like a fixed, you know, income, and it's harder to go out to eat or harder to do things.
Yeah, don't handicap yourself in your golden age. I'm here to kind of challenge everybody and just say, you don't know what you're going to be like when you're 60. I know what my parents are like when they're 60, and they love life right now. They're, you know, they don't have crazy amounts of money, but they're going on cruises once a month. They're, you know, they're very, very active. You don't want to be handicapped when you're older. Don't tie yourself into a fixed income now at 30 based on a calculation, and you assume that you're going to be the same person when you're 60 as when you're 30, because life is going to change for sure.
Yeah, that's definitely true. I think another possible solution that I'm okay with, no one ever talks about, is living extra frugally in recession times and then just kind of like taking less than 4% when it's really bad. And just saying, like, you know, because if everyone else is broke, then it's okay to be extra broke.
Yeah,
and that's just true. Like, all right, like, you know, we're on a downturn. I'm going to withdraw 3% instead of 4%.
Yeah, it works. I'd prefer to ball out during recession time because everything's on sale.
That is true, know? As well.
And then you're really standing out because everyone else is hiding in their closet.
That is true, except for when you see that big chunk of your net worth coming down.
That's right. Yeah, and that's almost impossible to avoid unless you're on like some super conservative investments, which we're not in. So
yeah, exactly. So that could be another possible solution. If you guys have any solutions, let us know in the Boss Lounge. We would love to hear them. But I kind of want to leave it with some of I really believe that overall the FIRE movement is very beneficial to people. Mm-hmm. Everyone should think about, you know, the possibility of financial independence. Know what your number is. You know, do the calculation to see what it would be like if you hit your FIRE number. But there are a lot of downsides of the FIRE movement as well that hopefully this podcast episode will help people with. A big part of it is not enjoying life right now. Mm-hmm. There's so many people in the FIRE movement that are just so, they're living so cheaply that they're not enjoying life now. And we're here to tell you, you don't have to. You can still enjoy life and do things, you know, especially if you don't mind taking advantage of location arbitrage. But just in general, like, don't stay home, cancel your Netflix, and eat rice and beans every day for the next 20 years to hit your FIRE number. I think there's a better way.
Dude, I agree totally. I think people are trying to over-identify with this, and they're rushing their number and trying to aim for a quicker exit per se. And I think it's really dangerous because you have to remember, like, yeah, mini retirement's great. Like, take a year off, 2 years. But there's no better time to make money than right now. Like, when you're 35 and you just hit your FIRE number, your best time to make money is also right now, because you've just achieved your FIRE number through knowledge, experience, network, contacts, being valuable. And if you take 5 years off and kind of do nothing, your skill set's going to diminish. And remember, the world's changing really, really quick. The skills that you have to do a business now are going to be different, not as usable in 5 years when you want to restart. So I would just challenge everyone, try to level up a little bit. Don't try to rush into this. If you need a small retirement, great. You're gonna enjoy it. It's going to make you appreciate some things more. But don't cut yourself short. Don't assume that your 30s are going to be better than your 70s. I've talked to a lot of people that said their 70s, the best years of their life. They don't have worry. They're just out doing all the things they want to do. They're not trying to date and things. So don't assume that your years now are more valuable than your years when you're 70. Don't shortcut yourself, but go out and do what you want to do, and don't be afraid to take at least a mini retirement.
Yeah, definitely. And you know, one thing that you mentioned there that I really want to highlight is, yeah, it's nobody in the FIRE community is talking about making more money, mm-hmm. or starting a business or the side hustle. I think they go hand in hand. I think if you can do both, that is the ultimate combination. I think too many entrepreneurs never talk about saving money. I know a lot of people who make 200, 300 grand a year, and they spend 200 or 300 grand a year. I think those people are also financially stupid.
Yeah.
I think that, you know, I mean, if you're making 30 grand a month, you know, just crushing it with like internet marketing, and you're spending 30 grand a month just balling out, it's not wise, because you have nothing to show for it once that campaign dries out.
Absolutely.
Or something happens.
You gotta have a real good look at your income stream and be, have a real truthful conversation with yourself about how realistic that is to continue. I think a lot of people out there think that it's going to go on for 10 years. They need to ask four or five of the smartest people around them to say, where do you think this is going? Because a lot of things dry up. You get replaced by someone that's younger, hungrier, and is willing to sleep less than you. And all of a sudden, the campaign that you're running or the business that you have is no longer as relevant or producing. So you got to be careful there. And just one more thing on kind of the association with work is that I was talking to this anthropologist the other day. It's also like part psychiatrist. And he's like, man, I know so many people that they work until they're 60 in New York just to go retire in Florida. And they hit it. They go retire in Florida. And a year later, they die because their body is just so out of balance of before and also after. You have to think like, and working 5-6 days a week, 8-10 hours a day, that's way out of balance. Like life shouldn't be like that. But also doing nothing all day is also out of balance. So find your balance. And that's where your FIRE lifestyle should be focused on, is balance. And work should be an element of that.
Yeah, 100% agree. I don't think anyone should work 80 hours a week. I also don't think anyone should work 0 hours a week. Mm-hmm. For me, that balance is working, you know, 4 hours a day, you know, or like on the days I want to work and then not working when I don't want to.
Yeah, I agree.
So another big part is being cheap. I think there's a big difference between being cheap and being frugal. I've always been frugal. I enjoy being frugal. I love being frugal, but I don't ever want to be cheap. And I don't think being cheap is good for you, your friends around you, your family, or society.
Or society. Dude, I think you said that perfectly. I'm so glad we touched on this. My dad reminded me of this about 6 months ago when I was in Florida, and I'm like, I was complaining about furnishing my apartment and just like expenses and stuff. And my dad just looks at me, he's like, Sam, it's okay to be frugal, but you never want to be thought of as cheap. So be careful of all this like over obsession about expense, because that's the world I came from. I came from a very frugal world, with limited expenses. And then as you make more money, you tend to spend more money, but you sometimes don't forget where you were or where you came from. And definitely with friends and people, it's nice to be generous. It's nice to pick up the tab for people when you go have lunch, even if they're doing better than you. It's nice to be generous. Don't ever be cheap, but being frugal is good. It's a smart way to go about life in general.
Yeah, 100%. You know, if you refuse to go out to eat with friends because, you know, you're trying to over budget and you're like, no, I'm not going to go out. I'm not going to see you. I don't care if you're in town for 2 days. I'm not going to go out to eat. That's just being cheap. And that's not good for your friendship. That's not good for anyone.
I think that's, as you said, I think that's one of the big negative personas of the FIRE movement, is that people see everyone as being cheap or living in you know, third world countries and kind of exploiting it to a large degree, trying to negotiate coffee prices and stuff. I mean, you see it. Like, it's a joke, but sometimes it's sad too. And no one wants to identify with those people that are also doing that. And sometimes that you know, unfortunately, the whole movement gets a rap like that.
Yeah, 100%. It's okay to be frugal and not get ripped off. I don't think it's good to, you know, overpay for things either. You know, and it's not good for, I don't think it's good for society to overpay either, because it just gets people's expectations crazy. But trying to negotiate that last 30 cents on something and like getting one over on the other person, especially if there's some like poor Thai woman, you know, and that's charging a fair price, but you're just like, no, I know I can get it less. Don't do that.
You should get your visa revoked.
You know, but at the same time, don't overpay because it messes up for everyone else.
I agree.
So I'm a big fan of watching like van life videos, but I've come to the harsh realization where the videos I watch are people that enjoy like, you know, van life to a nice way, where they have a beautiful, you know, they have a beautiful van. They go rock climbing or mountain biking. They're enjoying life. There's a lot of people in the FIRE movement that don't take photos of their van, or nobody looks at it, because the line between van life and just being homeless and living out of your car,
it's thin.
It's very thin.
It's very thin.
That is not a good way to live your life. I don't recommend that for anybody. You know, if you're going to do van life and save money or tiny homes and you can have a beautiful minimalistic home, I think that's great. But if you're just like a hobo, just living in a Walmart parking lot in a Toyota Yaris, that's not good for you.
And it's a slippery slope too. Once your income dries up and you haven't educated yourself on investing and how to put the money to work for you, all of a sudden that dream life of traveling around in a van and staying in nice, you know, RV parks and things that are actually really, really nice, all of a sudden you start taking 3 days a week and living in Walmart shopping center, and all of a sudden it's 5 days a week. And then all of a sudden you're like in this huge hole and you've got yourself into a really bad pickle. So I think the point is to go into this with a plan, a holistic plan that looks at everything that you want to do. What's your lifestyle going to be? Planning for a different lifestyle possibly in 10 years or 20 years, because you don't know what you're going to be like then, or if you're going to have kids, family, liabilities, whatever, new desires. And then also taking the time, and if you're listening to this episode, hopefully you've been following along Johnny and my journey in investment for a while, but really educate yourself on financial matters, and especially investing, because that is what is going to secure you. If you want to apply the 4% rule, that's what's going to get you there. It's what's going to allow you to do that. But making 5%, while it can be easy if you put in the time, it's not guaranteed, and certainly not easy if you don't understand investing.
Yeah, definitely. So to close it up, I want to ask you this question, and I'll answer it as well. Since you've hit your FI number, now how many years ago?
28. But I never had a FI number. It just happened, right?
Yeah. But when you accidentally hit your FI number, what made you, why do you still work now? Why do you still earn money? Why do you do it?
Initially, I never thought about it, but looking back, I would say it was identity. So once I had the exit when I was 28, it was almost like a band that had a great song. And you don't want to be that guy that had a one-hit wonder, right? And so identity was a huge part of it. And I also felt like, okay, well, I'm on this big upswing right now, and I have a lot of experience and resources I can leverage. So why not keep going? Let's continue down this route. It's been a lot of fun. It's been stressful, but it's worked out. So let's continue going. I think early retirement becomes easier as you go along if you set it up correctly. The first 2 or 3 years were really difficult for me. All my friends were working. I wasn't into these communities, like meeting people like you. I was basically by myself all the time, and I had come from an office of a business that I built that had 100 people, and I was the nucleus of that business. And that was an incredible feeling that you didn't appreciate until it was over and it was gone, and you can't just rebuild that. So for me, it was trying to recreate that. But after 2 or 3 years of doing the hardcore entrepreneurship again, I just realized it's kind of diminishing returns. If I go out and double or triple my wealth right now, it's not that big of, it's not going to change my lifestyle. And I've just gotten a lot more comfortable doing what we're doing. So I would say that I enjoy working because it's a necessary ingredient in my balanced life. And I think I'll always do something creative. Like, I have visions of the future. I have a nice cabin in Tahoe, and I'm there all winter, and I have a great office and study with a fireplace, and I'm knocking out creative work, 4 or 6 hours a day, and then going skiing or something. So it's just an important balance in my life, and I like being around people that are, hungry and working on something meaningful. It's like a nice feeling.
I like it. Yeah. Good, very good answer, and thanks for being transparent and open about that.
Yeah, how about you, John?
Because, I mean, for me, my FI number, I guess when I retired technically last year, I was at around, 550,000 net worth or something. So my calculation was 1,800 a month. And that was enough for me to continue living in cheap places like Thailand, maybe Bali, maybe, a few other places in the world. And there's plenty of people who retire in Thailand, and they would be very happy to have $1,800 a month. Mm-hmm. And they would live a great life. What I've realized is I want to have the option to not live here if I ever don't like it. I don't want to be that old grouchy expat who complains about things, spends all day on Facebook forums or on, online forums, and just complains because I'm stuck. Things have changed. Things are more expensive now. More people have come in, and I am 100% sure that the reason why they're so grouchy is they have nothing better to do.
Yeah.
And they have no control of their life and their destiny because they can't afford to go anywhere else.
Yeah.
And I realized I never want to be that guy. So I've decided I want to increase my FI number from 600,000 or so to minimum 1.2 million. So then that way I can double that amount, because with about, 3,600 or 4 grand a month, I can live in more places. It's kind of more variety of places to live in.
Mm-hmm.
now I actually want to increase that even more because I've realized it's not just about me. I want to have the option to be able to have a family and have kids. And I want to be able to continue supporting my parents in their retirement.
Right.
You know, right now I'm giving my parents $1,000 a month for their retirement. Plus I'm paying their property taxes every year. So that doesn't leave me much left in my, you know, my 40 grand a year if I was to cash that out, right?
Right.
So now I have to increase my FI number to be able to support them as well. So it's one of those things where now it's no longer just about me. It's about the future me. It's about other people. It's about future kids, future opportunities. And I'm very, very grateful that I'm able to enjoy life now while still earning money. And I think that's what I want to leave everyone with is this is even though hitting FIRE is great and I think it should be a goal for everyone, it's not the end of the road. And I don't think that I wouldn't be 100% happy if I just hit FI and said, okay, I'm retired now. And I don't think most people would either.
Let me ask you, because I've heard you say before on a previous episode that your goal, not necessarily your goal, but your number where you wouldn't worry about money ever again was 3 million. So how do you distinguish FIRE number versus your kind of dream number?
So for me, the FIRE number is kind of the minimum mm-hmm. that is required to be able to be independent and retire.
Right.
The dream number, you know, which is always going to be higher, is not only do I have my basic things kind of taken care of, I'll be able to have extra money to be able to do things like fly business class mm-hmm. or go on more expensive trips.
I like it. And I think that's an important distinction that people should think about. It's how much can I be comfortable with if I'm at FIRE? And then what would be a more aspirational number that would allow me to live a more ideal lifestyle and really never worry about things? And I think also what you said was great about your parents and stuff. We want to be able to do things for our parents when we're younger and also give a nice lifestyle to our children. And man, I haven't really done the calculations, but both are probably going to be around the same time if we decide to have children, and that could get really expensive. So I think planning for things like that and not just planning for yourself is really, really sound advice. A couple other things that I just wanted to summarize with just a little bit of advice about the movement is that when you've reached your number, I would suggest to make sure that you maintain some type of income, whether passively investing or some type of active part-time income stream, so that you don't spend your money down for at least the first 2 years. Once you get into it, you're going to be enjoying life. You're going to be doing a lot of things, taking a lot of liberties. Try not to let that money go down because it'll take pressure off you while you're seeing, is this for you? Do you want to start working again? Do you want to buy a house? Whatever you want to do, give that some thought. And another piece of advice is IRAs. A lot of people I know are banking on their IRAs for retirement. There are IRAs, for any of the international listeners, are a Roth IRA is a vehicle that U.S. people can save each year, and their money can grow tax-free, and they can take it out, I think, when they're 59 tax-free. So I would definitely use that vehicle, but I would be cautious because we don't have control over that IRA per se. The government does. And as we get older, that number to remove that money might increase, and it has in the past. So it's 59 now. By the time we're ready to, quote-unquote retire, that number could be 65 or 70. So don't put all of your eggs in that basket and, like Johnny said, diversify.
I love it. So this was a long episode, but I think it was really useful. This is one of the episodes where I really encourage you to share with all your friends, all your family, anyone who you think would benefit from this. So take a screenshot of the episode. Go to investlikeaboss.com. You can find the link to this episode and just share the link with your friends. If you enjoyed it, please go to iTunes and leave a review. It really helps us just get this message out to more people. And hopefully we'll see all of you guys out here in Chiang Mai. We're doing a Invest Like a Boss meetup here.
Yeah.
I think the dates are January 3rd?
Yeah, 3rd or 4th, or maybe both.
Yeah. So if you guys can make it out here January 3rd and 4th, 2019, we'll talk about it in the Boss Lounge. If you want to stay for a month and get to know Chiang Mai a bit more, I'm hosting the Nomad Summit, which is a conference for people who work online, which is going to tie into this very nicely as well, on January 19th. So just stay a few weeks, stay a month, and info on that is nomadsummit.com. But please talk about it in the Boss Lounge. Tell us about your fine number, where you are now. We'll share all the information there. I think it's really, really exciting for everyone to start thinking about this at least.
Absolutely. And if you guys want to hear more about how Johnny and I invest, if you are not familiar yet, you want to see our asset allocations and how we generate 5%+ returns on our investments, check out any of our quarterly updates. Usually we're talking about all of our investments. If you haven't heard one yet, stay tuned. In about 3 weeks, we'll do our big end of the year one. We'll talk about all of our investments, how the performance was, and how much cash we're generating.
Exactly. So till then, guys, stay bossy. Thanks for listening. And hope all of us hit our fives.
Fire.
Thanks for listening to the Invest Like a Boss podcast. Join our mailing list at investlikeaboss.com to get exclusive access to our insider investment portfolios and our private members forum.
If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe on iTunes or your favorite podcast app. Tell your friends and leave us a review in the iTunes store. It helps more than you know. See you guys next week.